Hi, this is your host, Mendel Gottlieb, and I am here with Rabbi Ariel Greenberg. And Ariel, he is originally from Long Island, New York, and he made an aliyah to Israel, and now he's back in the U.S., back in America. So we're really happy for you to be here with us and to give us your experience, give us your insight. So I want
to... Thank you.
I wanted to first start off with sort of if you could give us an overview about mental health, sort of because people hear terms like psychologist, psychiatrist, psychosis. They hear all these words and phrases, and most people are not familiar. People are familiar about sushi, what type of sushi there are. It's different, but psychology and psychiatry and stuff like that. So if you could sort of give us an overview of what the field looks
okay.
like.
Okay. So you also asked me to give myself a little bit of an introduction of my background in the field of mental health. So I will give a lot of credit to my parents, who are both involved somewhat in the mental health field. My father, for many years, for decades, was a guidance counselor in a high school. And he had to deal with giving a lot of guidance to a lot of mental health issues, although may not be in the level of a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but he was definitely dealing with mental health issues. And my mother, who trained originally as a nurse, eventually went into the field of occupational therapy, which eventually led her to dealing with people in psychiatric hospitals or psychiatric situations and nursing homes, where there were people on various levels of function, and that would help her. And she was dealing with people with psychological issues. And I was brought up by these two wonderful parents, who used to discuss with confidentiality, would discuss various experiences they had over the course of the day, without mentioning any names. Without them mentioning any private or personal details, but they would bring home their experiences, what they grew from dealing with these people, how to accept human beings for who they are as human beings with their handicaps. There are people with stomach aches who are still human beings. There are people with broken legs who are still human beings. There are people with the flu or corona who are still human beings. So there are also people with mental health issues who are still human beings, whether it's depression, whether it's anxiety, various levels of coping or not coping with life. And all these people, they're all still human beings. They're still valued as human beings. They're still Hashem's creations. And the Mishnah says, Ahov es habrios. We carve in the Torah, we need to respect people who are creations of God and give them the godly respect that Hashem gave them by creating them, and they're human beings for the best of their ability, and they have handicaps. So over the years, I learned from my parents to accept human beings as being human beings, even with handicaps, which I understand is not so easy. Sometimes you have to protect yourself from these people. Sometimes you have to distance yourself from these people. They might not treat you emotionally or even financially or even physically in a secure way. Some of them you have to distance yourself from, but in general, if you treat them like people, they'll treat you like people. So that's what I learned from my parents. So eventually, I was a Baruch Hashem, I was Zochet, and my parents sent me to yeshiva for many years in elementary school and high school in Long Island, and eventually I went to Eretz Yisrael after high school. Baruch Hashem, I was zochet to live in Eretz Yisrael for 30 years. I went to various yeshivas over there and taught in yeshivas over there. And eventually I wanted to direct myself to help my fellow Jew in helping myself develop my skills that I developed from my parents and helping other Jews with those skills and learn psychology. So I went to various Frum courses in Eretz Yisrael, which were being offered at that time. I consider myself very lucky. So I've gone to Frum courses in Eretz Israel that were run by the given by Frum teachers under from auspices. They were giving a Torah, a valid Torah perspective on psychology. And therefore, I am very lucky, because I'm myself very lucky to have a what I think is a good background in psychology, although I don't practice it today. I've chosen other paths, but I still am very, very involved in the field. So getting back to your question, as far as the difference between psychiatry and psychology, maybe therapy or coaching, there are people with real, real clinical diagnosed issues that are very serious and can be very disabling, that require psychiatric, sometimes psychiatric hospitalization, sometimes a forced hospitalization by the police to protect them from themselves. And these are very serious situations. And
what would be an example? Like bipolar?
Somebody who would need hospitalization would be somebody who's having psychosis, let's say, and really lost their mind, lost their sense of reality, and is doing dangerous things to themselves just because they're not really realizing where they are, what they're doing.
So they're not in control.
They're not in control of themselves. Very good. They're not in control of themselves. They're not aware of their surroundings. They're not aware of reality. They could just simply do something dangerous without even intending. They might not be intending to commit suicide. We're not talking about somebody who's intending to commit suicide. We're talking about somebody who doesn't know how many pills to take. Maybe he's supposed to take only one pill a day. He might, by accident, take 10 or 20 or 30, unfortunately.
So that's the extreme of psychiatry.
Correct.
Psychiatry also deals with bipolar or depression.
Right.
That's outpatient.
Right. As outpatient psychiatry could be people that are still in a very serious psychological state, like bipolar, as you mentioned, or as depression or anxiety. And for these people, Hashem created over the last 30 years, more or less, 40 years, medicines, advanced medicines. Some of the medicines were around for a long time, but over the last 30, 40 years, Hashem brought into the world various very good medicines that can treat a lot of situations and take people from being in situations where they can't cope with life, where they would have to be bedridden or homebound for the rest of their lives in many situations. Can't work, can't lead a marriage, can't raise children, can't even walk out of the house. And they're given medicines to help them live life, a more fulfilling life, and live through life in a very healthy way, in a coping way, where they can go to shul, they can go to school, they can do jobs, they can lead families because they're taking medicine. So many situations, medicine takes them from being incapable to being capable. Mm-hmm. That would be a psychiatrist.
And then after that would be
psychologist. Then there are people who may be a mix. They might be taking medicine and working with a psychologist at the same time, who's going to help them do exercises, what we call emotional exercises or behavioral exercises or what's called cognitive exercises, thinking exercises, which using these exercises will also help them develop themselves into capable people to lead normal lives. And these exercises are recommended stronger than medicine, because
it's therapy. So it's talk therapy.
It's not always talk therapy, but let's stick to talk therapy at this time, because that's the most conventional and most used therapy. And both psychiatrists and psychologists at this stage of the era of psychology both recommend more therapy than medicine, because medicine is where a person is taking something from the outside and depending on some external chemical to help his situation. And he could take that for the rest of his life, but we don't want him to take that for the rest of his life if he doesn't have to. Let him learn skills, life skills, that will help him get out of this problem on his own, and to live a capable life on his own, and be self-independent. with doing these exercises, whether it's emotional exercises or physical exercises or behavioral exercises or cognitive exercises, and live a fulfilling life on your own. There's a famous mashal: give a man a fish and he'll live for a day. Teach a man how to fish and he'll live a lifetime.
Right.
So we don't want to just want to give a person a pill. Sometimes we have to and we should, and it's highly recommended if somebody needs to. But we also want to make sure that they can learn the skills to live a life of their own, live a lifetime. And that's what a psychologist will teach a person. So there's doctors of psychology who deal with very difficult and serious situations. There are more serious situations. And then there are, let's say, there are licensed therapists who are dealing sometimes with less serious situations, or sometimes even with the same level of situations. Today, letters are interchangeable a lot, and you can have highly experienced therapists who are doing the same job as psychologists.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not exactly so black and white today. What's the difference between a psychologist and a mental health therapist?
Mm-hmm. Or counselor.
As long as they're licensed, more or less, they might all be doing the same thing, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Happens to me, as a doctor of psychology, he spent more years in school,
right,
which means he studied books more. But nevertheless, a mental health counselor or therapist who's licensed might have just as much years of experience as a psychologist, or even more years of his experience. And any psychologist and therapist will tell you what makes you better in the field is more years of experience.
Mm-hmm.
Than more years of reading books. Reading books is good for a certain amount of years. Then after that, it's not going to do it for you.
Right.
Reading more and more books and more information, sitting behind a desk in school and taking more tests, is not going to make you a better psychologist, psychotherapist. What's going to make you better is experience in the field. Experience and what's called supervision. Every good psychologist and therapist and mental health counselor expects of themselves, and their field expects of them to go to what's called supervision, which means they themselves have to answer to somebody more advanced than them in school in the field,
mm-hmm.
and expects of them to live on a higher standard of ethics and grueling expectations of themselves. How professional of a job are they doing? How expertise of a job are they doing? How much are they really working hard on the client? How much are they cutting corners or being lazy in their work? Or how much are they actually requiring of themselves to do a good job?
Mm-hmm.
That's the sign of a good therapist, because this costs money. A therapist who's going to supervision, sometimes once a week, sometimes more, sometimes less, is spending their own money
mm-hmm.
on making sure that they're doing a good job.
Right.
Sometimes there's nobody watching them,
right?
And then nobody expecting them to go to supervision. They themselves are voluntarily expecting of themselves to go to supervision, and those therapists are the better therapists.
Right. So in the more extreme cases of psychiatry or psychology, in that case, is it a physical problem or it's a mental, spiritual, emotional problem? You know, where is the problem stem?
So that's a great question. Where is the problem? We're used to a toe ache. It's in the toe.
Right. We know, you know, you go to a podiatrist for your foot. You go to a dentist for your teeth. You know, each doctor specializes in their particular area. And the question is it a physical problem? Or is it a mental, emotional problem?
Right, right. So Baruch Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave doctors over the last 40 years more and more insight into the human creation, the creation of the human being, and into the creation of human brain, and into the chemicals of the human brain.
Mm-hmm.
So by now, the doctors have discovered that a human brain, HaKadosh Baruch Hu created a human brain with chemicals
regulate
a person's feelings,
right?
person's happy, then certain chemicals are acting a certain way.
Right.
If a person's sad, then different chemicals are working in a different way. If a person's depressed, then he has a certain different regulation of chemicals. If
he's, so it's a physical, so it's not that he's sad, is that the chemicals are making him sad or suicidal.
Or happy.
Mm-hmm. So, manic.
Right.
Right.
So I wouldn't say the chemicals are not exactly making them. He is his behaviors or his attitudes or his feelings or his life experience is driving the chemicals to work in a certain way. And so you might call these doctors of chemicals, if you wish.
Right.
A psychiatrist might be called a doctor of chemicals who can prescribe certain chemicals to help him regulate those chemicals in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
But as we said before, we prefer to ask people to do exercises which will change those chemicals. A person himself can control his own chemicals by doing behavioral exercises, by doing cognitive exercises,
right,
by doing emotional exercises, by changing his environment, by changing his friendships. A person himself is in control of his chemicals. Just like you could pick up your arms or legs, you could walk, you could talk, you could choose to eat, you could choose not to eat, you can choose to talk, you could choose not to talk. So you can also choose your chemicals. It's a little more sensitive, it's more nuanced, it's a little more delicate.
Right.
But a person can certainly change his chemicals, his chemical regulation, right, we call it.
Because I was thinking, when you go to a doctor, and let's say you have high blood pressure or some, they may give you medication, but they're also going to tell you you have to regulate your lifestyle. You have to start eating healthier, you have to do exercise. So it's not just a pill. They're you got to work on everything together.
Absolutely.
So that's, it's similar to
that's that. That's the present hashkafa, so to speak, of the psychological world and the psychiatric world. The main thing is to change your lifestyle. And that's the hardest part. It's easy to take a pill for most people, for some people, whatever.
Right.
But the hardest thing is to change your lifestyle. As we know from Rabbi Yisrael Salanter used to say, that it's easier to finish all shas than to change a midah.
Mm-hmm.
And that really applies here also. To change a lifestyle is a big, big task for everybody.
Right.
You're used to a certain way of life, you have certain friends, certain way of talking, certain way of attitudes,
right,
certain emotions, certain reactions, certain way of doing things. And that takes a lot to change a habit. It's not just one habit, it's a lifestyle habit. And in order to change your chemicals, you got to change your lifestyle.
Right.
That's a big deal, but that's the goal. That certainly is the goal.
So by changing your environment, your attitude, your routine, your food, it could work the other way around.
Correct. You can send your chemicals back into health, into balance, into regulation.
Right.
You can make yourself happy.
Right. But you need a specialist to let you know if you could do it on your own, or you need the medicine. Plus, like, the medicine's coming from above,
right?
And your work is from like Lamata. It's like you're doing,
right,
the work,
right?
So you need that expert to let you know. You know,
you would want to go to an expert to help you,
right?
Hopefully, you make the own decision by yourself. And all psychologists, right, and psychiatrists want you to come to a decision on your own,
right? To change,
right? So they might help you make a decision if you need medicine, or right, if you don't need medicine. And it will also, psychologists also help you realize on your own which lifestyle habits you need to change.
Right. So another question. So where does the shame come from? Like, why is it if you have a strep throat, if you hurt your foot, there's no problem wearing a cast. There's no problem wearing your pain. And there is no shame. Where did seeing a psychologist or the mental health professional, how did that develop where it's embarrassing to either go to a psychologist or admit that you're seeing a therapist?
It seems historically people were supposed to, in society, show themselves as strong, hide their vulnerabilities. It seems there was some historical culture not long ago that we don't have today so as much, that a person needs to show themselves as invulnerable.
So is that a masculine thing, or it's both?
Both. Uh-huh. From as far as I understand, even women, I didn't live that historical period.
Right.
But as far as I understand, all people, all human beings, this historical background, were needed to show themselves as strong, that I could do, I don't have any problems, I don't have any handicaps.
So it was like a survival thing because they were busy?
Survival, maybe it's, you could call it survival, but it was culturally accepted. That's what
to be tough.
Either be tough or strong, to be strong.
Right, strong-minded.
Strong-minded and not to show your vulnerabilities, not to show yourself weak. And maybe some people were natural at that. Maybe some people were actually strong. And the people who were not strong needed to show themselves strong, even if they were not strong.
Right.
I believe there's some...
So there's a shame of admitting that right. You're not independent, that you're right. Not self.
Right. Right. You had to show that you can't show your dependency on other people.
But to go to a doctor, why is that not showing dependency if you're physically hurt?
So once again, there must have been some cultural component, some cultural ingredient in that society, that if your toe hurts, that doesn't show you're a weak person.
Right.
You have a problem with your toe.
Right.
If you have a stomach ache, you're not a weak person.
Right.
I would imagine even there were some physical things that were also
ignored.
If you had some internal organs that were not working right, there was some right. heart problem. I'm guessing there was also a stigma or a shame to admit that in public that you have some internal organs that are not working correctly.
Right.
But to show yourself you have emotional problems, that, you know, nobody has emotional problems. Today, thank God, both in the secular world and in the Jewish world and the Frum world, it's becoming more and more accepted for people to be honest with that they have problems, they have vulnerabilities, and that God created us intentionally with weaknesses and vulnerabilities to face them and to work on them. And somebody who takes responsibility to work on their vulnerabilities or weaknesses is considered a responsible Jew,
right.
A responsible person. A person who has weaknesses and is working on taking responsibilities for weaknesses is respected as an honest, responsible person, as a respectable person in society. And mm-hmm. we need to, in case anyone doesn't have that respect yet, we need to
educate them
that this is a responsible person. This is a respectable person. A person who goes for therapy, who needs to go to therapy.
Right. It's not a shame. It's a good thing. It's a productive thing.
It's a productive thing. It's a sign of strength.
Right. Instead of ignoring an infection
right.
and letting it get it worse.
Exactly. It's a sign of strength and courage that you have, that you admit to your weaknesses and you're willing to take them on. That's a respected person, and we need to respect people like that. And I personally, obviously, that's not as accepted yet. But right. I would like to say in public, this person goes to therapy. He's a chosh of a person. He's a person who takes responsibility. I was just a person who is a manager in a company, so he's a responsible person.
Right.
Hopefully, he's a responsible. He takes responsibility for his workers and his company.
Right.
A person who runs a business is a responsible person for his business. Hopefully a husband and parents are responsible people for their family. So a person who's going to therapy and working on himself is, in my eyes, a very highly respectable person. He's taking responsibility for himself.
Right. So is mental health and psychiatrists, more psychologists, is that meant for only people that have problems, or anyone could benefit from therapy or friendship or
so and that's also a question which relates to the stigma, historical stigma change, being that today we don't look at psychology, at emotional issues, as having a stigma, as something shameful. So the truth is, going back to what I said a minute ago, Hashem created each person in the world with milos and chesronos, with qualities and challenges, with great things to give to the world, and great gifts to give to the world, and great challenges to overcome.
Right.
And Hashem created each person with their handicaps to overcome. And many people, if not all people, are created with emotional health handicaps, and life challenges, and life situations in parenting, or friendships, or relationships,
right.
or marriages, that everybody has to work on their developing themselves and their midos for avodas Hashem.
So it's not like if you don't have problems, you know, like if someone has a specific medical condition and it's very specific to him, you know, he'll study that particular thing. But no one else is interested in that particular medical issue because it's only his thing. But are you saying mental health and emotional health, it's not just for people that have problems that can't function, but mental health and emotional health, it's everyone's problem, so to speak. Or everyone could work on emotional well-being.
Right. Everyone could work emotional well-being. Everybody should. But maybe we don't want to use the word problems.
Right.
Maybe we want to use the word challenges and growth in Avodas Hashem.
Right.
Everybody was created with these challenges, these Avodas Hashem, these individual Avodas Hashem challenges. And everybody's expected to work on their emotional health. Now, they might want to get this from a coach, or from a parent, or from a Rebbe, or from a therapist. With people who have bigger challenges, might be born with bigger challenges, or develop traumas which may give them bigger challenges, those people might need to go to a professional.
Right.
Depending on which level of professional. So mental health in general, everybody needs mental health, everybody needs to develop mental health, everybody needs to live with health. But some people have more serious problems than others, and need a more serious doctor, so to speak, and a serious, right, treatment for their challenges.
What I don't understand is that Judaism is very intellectual. I mean, we're the people of the book. We're constantly learning. You know, we're supposed to learn day and night. We have an obligation to learn day and night. It doesn't seem to me that there's a lot of room for emotions. You know, even davening, it's supposed to be an emotional experience. You shake and you know what I'm saying? But davening doesn't take up most of the day. It's most of our day is supposed to be, unless you're working, but you're supposed to be dedicating yourself to study. And there's a big emphasis on literacy and studying. So where does emotional, it seems more for like the, you know, I don't know, for the weaker people or for the, you know, is it something for everybody? Emotional well-being?
So this is a big misnomer of the Western society. That the Western society, the secular Western society, believes a lot into, at least puts a lot of emphasis for those who are developing themselves. The more intellectual you are,
right,
the more of an advanced human being you are. Monkeys were not intellectual. Humans are more intellectual. That's the general secular attitude. So if you want to be more advanced than a monkey, you go to college for 2 years. If you want to be even more advanced than the guy who went to college 2 years, you go to 4 years. You go to 6 years, you go to 10 years.
So the higher degree you have, like the PhDs and MDs, they have less emotional feelings because they're busy 10, 15 years studying,
so
academics.
So I'm not saying they're more or less, but I'm just saying the society, the cultural society we live in, encourages more intellectual pursuits
and less emotions,
and less emotion as a description of a more advanced human being.
Right.
Einstein is still living today in the culture, believe it or not. I think he must be passed away already, maybe 50 years or more, and he's still the classic example of Western society as the most advanced human being in Western society, because he invented many scientific equations and ideas and developments in science. He used his brain the furthest a man could ever develop his brain,
right,
his intellect. So you'll still use it in culture and in science and advertisements till today. Oh, that he's an Einstein. Right. He's the smartest guy. Or do you want to be an Einstein?
Right.
Or there might be some pop psychology books on how to become an Einstein.
Right.
What do you want to do in order to develop yourself to be the most advanced human being in society?
Right, but you can't build a bridge on feelings and emotions. Light bulbs, everything you see in this world, an airplane, was not a group of people having feelings and emotions. And, you know what I'm saying? It was intellectual engineers that were like, you know, could sit there for hours and study and have very advanced mathematical degrees and really. So, how could you say that emotions and feelings are that important when you look at the world? Everything you see, it's, you know, requires intellect.
Right. So, Baruch Hashem, we're from Jews, and we don't judge things based on what we see with our physical eyes.
Right.
we have a Mesorah that is more to the world than what we see with our physical eyes.
Right.
The Torah prescribes to us that life is not just about intellect.
Mm-hmm.
Life is not just about facts and figures and information. Right. Life is not about sitting on Google all day and leading your life a Google way of life.
Right.
Just making every decision you make based on Google.
Right.
You have to have a Torah way of life. And the Torah tells us many, many times in mitzvot and in Chumash and the Sifrei Musar and the Sifrei Avot of Chassidus and the Sifrei Svarim. Throughout Torah mitzvot, we find that we have mitzvot prescriptions to have emotions, use our emotions in Avodah Hashem. Well, it's through Tefillah. It's Avodah. Tefillah is called an Avodah Shebelev. We daven three times a day. We're supposed to use our hearts. We have Emunah. Emunah is an emotional connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You have to have, in order to have Emunah, you have to have an emotional faith. To have Bitachon, you have to have emotions. To love HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Avas Hashem, Yiras Hashem, these are emotions. To love another Jew is emotions. They're full and full. Tons and tons of mitzvos
that are emotional.
That are emotional. And the Torah commands us we have to use our emotions. You can't be a frum Jew, a complete frum Jew, without using your emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And the Torah that we learn in Yeshiva and Beis Yaakov over and over again, which is a Torah, which is maybe an intellectual Torah,
right?
But we're learning that we are required to have emotions. The various mitzvahs, halachos, and gemaras, and sources that we learn throughout the day are telling us to have emotions, and we're hopefully going to practice them when we walk out of school.
Mm-hmm. So let's say in relationships, in a marriage, the husband works hard, he works, he's motivated, gets up to work, he helps in the house, takes out the garbage, helps with the dishes. He does everything physical, everything that's required, everything she asks, he does, you know. And sometimes the wife would say, you're not expressing your appreciation for what I do, or you're not talking in a loving language, and you're not. And the husband could say, well, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. I took out the garbage. Do you want me to say I love you and not take out the garbage? You know, what would you rather have? Would you rather have me doing the action, getting the things done, or being all emotional but not actually getting the stuff done?
Right, that's a classic question. I just wanted to clarify that this can go, it could be from the wife to the husband.
Right.
It could also be from the husband to the wife. We're not being any gender right. specific here,
yeah.
and taking any sides in such situations. It can go both ways. But to relate to your question. So once again, the Torah requires us, we have to do both. We have to balance. We have to be balanced people. Balanced, emotionally, mental, healthy people find a balance between their actions, between their decisions, between their thoughts, and between their emotions. And husbands have to be emotionally balanced. Wives have to be emotionally balanced. Both husbands and wives have challenges, contrary to some people's belief, that only one or the other spouse has challenges.
Right.
Both husbands and wives have their challenges in balancing their emotions with their decisions, with their thoughts, with their behaviors. And the Torah wants us to have both. The Torah wants us to be balanced people. We have to balance both, and we have to develop ourselves. That's why marriage is not just about having fun and getting some fun. On some level, we get married in order to develop ourselves. We become parents in order to develop ourselves. And that development takes work. So that's why Hashem put us in the world, to do more mitzvahs and to do more work on ourselves.
So you have to take out the garbage with a loving or an enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you have to, the Reach HaKamofa. When you're doing a chesed,
right.
The source of doing chesed is from love.
Right.
If you're doing a chesed to your spouse, whether it's a husband to wife or a wife to a husband.
So it's not good enough just to do it. You have to express it in words and in emotions.
And emotions. You have to feel it. You have to feel. You want to be able to feel it. It's not enough just to say it or to do it.
Right.
You want to feel it. If you're feeling it, then it's going to become easy to say it and do it. If you don't yet feel it, you definitely want to have the doing it and the saying it influence your heart, influence your feelings. You want to have a balance of all three together. Some people, it's easier for them to feel and harder for them to do. Mm-hmm. That's their challenge. Some people, it's easier for them to do and harder for them to feel.
Right.
As for some people, it's easier for them to do and feel and not to talk. For some people, it's easier to talk and not to do and feel. That's called balance. We need to have a full balance of all our facilities, our actions, our thoughts, and our emotions.
Right.
So that's the triangle of the human being. Actions, thoughts, and emotions. I don't know if there's some... Probably is some... And if, maybe that's Kof Mabina Das. I don't know if that relates to that.
I mean, how does Dibur... Like this.
How does Dibur... Dibur is also one of the other facilities. I'm not sure which Torah Moshel there is, right, for that. But that's certainly... The triangle of a person's life is his thoughts.
Because you use your dibur, your speech,
right,
to express
your feelings and your thoughts.
Right.
Absolutely.
Because how does someone know how you feel if you don't express it with words?
Well, a person, many times you and I can understand by our facial expressions,
right,
or our body language, the way we're standing, how a person feels. If you see a person crying and they don't say they're sad,
right,
you know that they're sad.
Right.
If you see a person smile and they don't say they're happy, they're probably happy.
Right.
So we certainly can understand and express our feelings not through words, but you want to do both. You want to have a balance of all the above. You want a person who's emotionally balanced. That we try to raise our children today as emotionally balanced children.
Mm-hmm.
Emotionally balanced adults, because we want to give them the life skills to develop themselves as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we need to do as parents and role model that as adults. That's our goal, to
right,
give a person chayim. The Gemara says in Kiddushin that a father is obligated to give a person a child life, either life through parnasa, life through Torah. The Gemara gives various examples of life. Mm-hmm. And today, our example of life is life skills, emotional life skills.
So not just swimming.
Not just swimming, not just parnasa,
right,
not just behaving properly in school or in the community. It's feeling emotional balance.
Mm-hmm. If someone's having some type of an emotional problem, not the huge problem, you know, just a basic, you know, stressors and stuff like that, is it better to go to a friend, a good friend of yours, or a Rav that knows your particular family, or is it better to go to outside professional that's objective? What's a better...
So that's a funny question. People need friends. People need rabbis.
Right.
People need mentors. People need parents.
Right.
And many people also need a therapist.
Right.
So it's not a one or the other equation.
Do some people sometimes go to therapists because they don't have those other relationships?
Absolutely. So right, so that's a classic example. A lot of people who are by therapists is because they don't have enough family or friends giving them the support and giving them the outside view. The great advantage of a friend frequently is somebody who looks from the outside and reflects back to ourselves what we don't see because we're biased for ourselves.
Right.
A friend is somebody who looks from the outside and sees what we don't see and tells us, oh, you have this problem, or you have this virtue, or you're stuck in this problem, you're stuck in this looking for the solution because you don't see this aspect that I see from the outside.
Right.
So many, many people are going to therapists because they don't have friends.
Right. And a friend is not somewhat a buddy you hang out and chill or you go bowling with, right?
Right.
A friend is someone you could talk to on an emotional level, right, about what's going on with your life.
Right. Because I'll say a friend is somebody you can share your secrets with.
Right.
And you can't share your secrets with everybody. It has to be somebody that you trust.
Right.
Who will keep your secrets safe.
Right.
And will also respect you for your vulnerabilities and your weaknesses. and even and still respect you,
right,
and give you some reflection on your issues, that things that bother you. So everybody has to have friends. Chazal said, "Kinei lecha chaver." It's a basic need.
Right.
Vasei lecha rav. You have to have a parent. You have to have a rebbe, and you have to have parents. Parents also lead you and direct you and care about you.
Right.
And a lot of people need a therapist, but that's not in place.
Right. It should be the ideal situation. You should have real friends.
Right.
A real rav, because a lot of the friends we have are people that we see in shul, and then the rav is someone you ask halacha questions to,
or hashgacha questions.
Right.
Or family hadracha questions, or chinuch questions.
Right. A rabbi. It should be a rav, but a lot of times a rav, you call a rav when you have a shaila, you have a halacha question, and you look at a rav as more of a legal scholar.
Chas v'shalom. A rav is a rabbi.
Right.
A rabbi is somebody that you talk about your halacha shailas.
Right.
And your hashgacha
shailas. An ideal rav.
And your personal shailas. Absolutely. Right. But a rav is not trained in mental health issues. It's not his training.
Right.
So just like he doesn't know how to fix a stomach ache, or a car, or a toe ache, or a high blood pressure. He's not trained in many other fields.
Right.
And a deal rav knows at a certain point this is a mental health issue, and not a personal hashkafa or hadracha issue. And that he needs to refer that to a mental health professional. Baruch Hashem, many, many rabbanim today are getting training in basic mental health knowledge, so they can know where to refer out where their knowledge ends and where somebody else's knowledge begins. And that's
are there any cases that you've seen or you heard about where someone has some type of problem, and instead of, let's say, dealing with it, instead of like getting over it, if it's a small issue, by going to a therapist, they're exacerbating the issue and we know all these cases, you know, with like, especially in the early psychology with Freud, where he would sit with you on a couch for, you know, and we know of people that they've been in therapy for years and years. And, you know, in the times of Freud, they didn't have medicine, so it was only talk therapy.
Right.
But is there any circumstance that you could think of that by talking about it, it's exacerbating the problem? It's making the problem worse than just getting over it and just having a friend or having a quick fix, walking away from the problem, or just mesiach das, just forgetting about the problem and not dwelling about it. What did my parents do and why did they do that? And you could end up going to therapy for years and years and trying to analyze. You know, that's one part of the question. And also, if there's a financial gain, just like with doctors, sometimes they'll overprescribe something, you know, because there's a financial, you know, in psychology also, there's a possibility that there's a financial motive to keep you there and to, you know, to keep you in therapy for longer and longer. So how do you know when it's something you should sort of just ignore and say, Mesiach Daita, you could just go away? And focus on something positive, like doing good stuff, helping someone. Instead of dwelling on your problems, do something positive that will get you away from your problems. You know.
Yeah. So that's a very common question, a very common dilemma. That how much is it a something just a small thing that he can take care of by himself? And if he would go to a therapist, it would make it more, he would dwell on it, because there are people who have a personality of dwelling.
Right.
And they might use the opportunity to go to a therapist.
And to dray it out.
To dray it out, to dwell it out, to spend more and more time on it. And they even want to spend more money. They want to pay money to a therapist in order to dwell on it more, because that's their personality. Like, they like to dwell.
Right.
And these specific people, not all people, but certain people, they should not be dwelling. So I hope that a good therapist will pick that up and tell the person, I'm going to help you, teach you to stop dwelling.
Right.
And if you're going to come to therapy, pay me money, I'm going to teach you to undo your personality of dwelling and to take things more lightly and to let it go, to ignore it, or just to take it lightly, talk it out to your friends, talk it out to your family,
right,
and just let it go and don't dwell so much.
Right.
Hopefully a honest and ethical therapist will notice that and make it a short therapy, shorten the therapy, teach them the skills how not to dwell.
Is there a trend of having less sessions? Like in the times of Freudian, when they would sit on a couch and talk about their mother and talk about everything that happened to them, is there sort of the further we get that it's therapy is becoming shorter and more focused and more like action oriented?
Absolutely. This history has developed psychology to the point where the goal is to make it shorter and shorter and shorter,
mm-hmm.
to the extent that it's sometimes being exaggerated by the insurance companies who pay for therapy, or even by certain schools of thought that we're going to make it as short as possible, which is really ridiculous because you can't. Somebody has a problem.
You can't fix it in one.
You can't fix it in one session. You can't even fix it in 10 sessions. A problem is, well, as we said before, in order to change a lifestyle, it takes time to change a lifestyle.
Right.
There are certain issues that sometimes people could, you know, so small issues that person could change in a few sessions. And there are miracle stories of a person with a heavy problem who went to a psychologist and he solved all the problems in one session. There are such miracle stories.
Right. Even with Rabbein, with rabbis, you know, they...
I'm talking about psychologists right now. Rabbis do
their own miracles.
But psychologists don't do miracles. But there are a few miracle stories where they said it's healed somebody overnight. There are such stories, which are true.
Right.
But that's not the norm. That's not typical. It's not to be expected. And it's not real. It's not real. In most cases, it's not real.
But is there the other extreme of going too long and dwelling, you know, on the couch? Like, you know, so it used to
today,
be.
Today, an ethical therapist is taught not to draw things out, not to dwell, not to pull things out.
So there's a balance of.
Right. The ethical therapist hopefully will say, you know, this is too much. We're dwelling on too much. We're going to move on to lighter things. And I know of certain therapists that will actually throw a client out after a certain amount of sessions. I feel this is dwelling too much. I don't want to waste your time. I don't want to waste your money.
Right.
And I want to accomplish things, not just for the client's sake, but also for the therapist's sake. The therapist wants to spend time helping people.
Right.
And I don't want to feel like I'm not helping somebody.
Right.
I want to feel like I'm doing something. Human being likes to feel that I'm accomplishing something. With you as my client, I don't feel like I'm accomplishing something. Leave. Don't come back next time. And I want to do things that I feel constructive. So hopefully, there are just like you said, there are doctors who make mistakes. There are doctors who are...
Overcharge.
Over-medicate. There are such things. We're living in an imperfect world. And certainly in the area of therapy, I have to say that because therapy and emotional health is cannot be measured as a doctor can measure medicine.
Right. It's not, the science is not a hard science.
It's not a hard science. It's a very, very unclear science. So therapists are more likely to be unclear as far as when to draw the line, as far as how long is long, how long is too long, or how short is too short. It's much harder, so for the merit of the therapist, I need to say that it's much harder for a therapist to draw these lines.
Mm-hmm.
And because they do care about people, they might be in a tendency to let them have a few more sessions to make sure that they're getting the empathy and the therapy that they need. But once again, a good ethical therapist who's going to supervision and checking out their work with a supervisor at a certain point will say, you know, this is not going the right direction. I'm wasting his time or her time. I'm wasting his or her money. And I'm wasting my own satisfaction. I'm not getting the satisfaction of this person because I'm not doing the job that I need to be doing with this person.
Right. I'm sure you're aware of these people called motivational speakers in both worlds.
Right.
And they claim that they could take somebody that was in therapy for years and years and with one great motivation, with one speech, a fire speech, and you know, they have actually also want to change too, but I'm saying, with a great fiery speech, they can make changes. And if they make a decision, you know, we know this too. Like if someone decides, you know what, I had enough. That's it. I make a decision, which means, you know, cut off. He's like, I'm deciding that this, I'm not doing this anymore from now on. He makes a chlata that's the way. Is that possible? Is it all hoax, or is there some validity to motivation and to change your life in one, you know, one speech and you're completely changed?
Chazal tell us about a case of someone named Rabbi Elazar ben Durdia,
right,
who changed his life in what Chazal called one moment, maybe it was 1 hour, in one step. He changed his whole life in one step. And he was a Rasha before that point, and Chazal gave him the title Rebbe because he changed himself so successfully in one step. We'll use the word one step. That is the very, very non-typical situation. It's the exception to the rule. It's what I would say.
So in an emotional issues, that cannot happen.
I'm not going to say it cannot happen, but it's like, I would say it's one in a million. Mm-hmm.
So those things don't work, motivational speakers, to change your life.
So I will admit that motivational speakers who are very good at motivating people might succeed at 1 in 10,000. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say that these people are fakes and liars and ganovim, that they take people's money for nothing. No, I'm not going to say that. I do believe that these people are very successful at what they do. They are very successful at changing people's attitudes and behaviors and emotions, but it's one in a million, or maybe 1 in 10,000, 1 in 100,000, that changes overnight. A lot of what does change overnight is people's direction. They might be motivating people overnight to change,
but the actual change
could might take years.
Right.
These are successful people. They're called motivational speakers because right. they wake up people and get them motivated. Just like you might have a car whose battery is dead, and you jump the spark plugs, you jump the battery, and you get the car started.
Right.
So now the car is started. It's the engine is running.
Right.
You still have to drive the car to get somewhere. You have to put the gas in the car, or you have to turn on the, you have to get the ignition going, and you have to take the car out of the driveway and start driving. So yes, these motivational speakers are very good to get people motivated.
Right.
But change always takes time.
So it's two separate things. Motivation and change is
right.
So ideally, you should have like a weekend where you have a motivational person,
right,
and you have therapists, so you're motivated. And as soon as you walk out of the motivation, you don't go home back to your life, but right away you talk to a therapist, and you'll have therapists available to talk, to change your...
But once again, these therapists are not going to change your life in one weekend.
Okay.
Change takes time. And right. after the motivational speaker turns you on, or the inspirational teacher gets you inspired, then you have to go through a long process of change to change your lifestyle. That's the biggest challenge we can have in your life, is to change your lifestyle. That could take...
So we're talking about changing your actions or your emotions?
Everything. Mm-hmm. Your actions, your emotions, your thoughts, your behavior, sometimes your friends.
Right.
So you could include you changing your diet, your sleep schedule.
Right.
Everything. To change your entire lifestyle is...
Cannot be done
in one night, in one day, in one minute.
One podcast.
In one podcast. It's totally impossible. It's totally impossible. The motivational speaker could turn you on in one moment. Mm-hmm. And then you could be spending the next 10 years changing.
Unpacking.
That's great. That's a person who's taking responsibility for his life.
Right. Well, it's been fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Mendel.
Thanks for joining us in our podcast, and I hope everyone found this very informative. I found this fascinating, interesting stuff. This is really, really good stuff.
I appreciated talking about it myself.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Have a great year.
Be well.